To get this started, I wanted to just give a little preface. I wanted to say that Dr. Bell tackles an impossible subject in this book, but it's extremely timely and valuable. And nothing, in my opinion, could be more valuable from an economic point of view than trying to better understand the Chinese government, because the Chinese government is, you might say, the most significant factor in the Chinese economy, you might say. And how the government performs is going to be dramatically impactful on what happens to the Chinese economy. And we've all seen a great example of that across the last few days, as we've seen the world just roiling with confusion and concern about what's going on with the Chinese economy. I have personally quite a bit of confidence in the Chinese government, and I think that concern is ill-founded, but let's move on. So he tackles an impossible subject, but it's timely and very valuable. We have failed government in the Middle East and other places in the world, and now we have many who see failed government here in the U.S., in the world's largest democracy. We know there are hundreds of thousands of protests in China every year, so many people think the Chinese are unhappy with their government, which Dr. Bell explains is a highly meritocratic government, very different from our one person, one vote rule democratic government. Which of these governments work better? At the end of this, I'd like to ask you kind of what is your opinion. So we'll do a little straw poll. Most of us think ours is, of course. That's where we're starting out. I like our government too, in a general sense. But China has sustained 10% annual GDP growth for 30 years and 7% now. China has not experienced one recession across that period. All the other major economies have. China has brought more than 600 million people out of poverty across that period. China plans to build 2,000 more airports before 2030. And based on what they've been doing with roads and bridges and airports, it's likely they could accomplish that goal if nothing goes wrong. While we can't seem to fix the ones that we have, and our bridges and tunnels and roads are deteriorating. While Chinese complain, they do complain about inflation, inequality, and corruption, according to the studies. Those are the three main things that are complained about. In a 2010 study, the Pew Research Group found that 62% of Americans were dissatisfied with our government, while only 9% of Chinese were dissatisfied. In fact, of the 22 nations in that survey, the next lowest dissatisfaction was Brazil at 49%. China had only 9% expressing dissatisfaction with their government. I bet that surprises some people here to know that. So Chinese are pretty satisfied with their government. Pew's study of global attitudes in 2014, 46% of Americans viewed inequality as a major challenge and only 42% of Chinese. In the U.S., only 30% believe the next generation will be better off in the future. In China, 85% believe, according to Pew, that the next generation will be better off. That's almost everybody in China believes the next generation will be better off based on a 2014 study by a very highly regarded research group, the Pew Research Group. So now to the questions, and now to Dr. Bell. Dr. Bell, one of the concerns with meritocracy is the issue of who decides the objective, which is the guide for meritocratically developed and chosen leaders at all levels to effectively pursue their skills. The Fountainhead, a 1949 book by Ayn Rand, pits integrity, genius, and independence against dependence and the demands of opinions, needs, and wishes of others. Do we want this kind of independent thinking in our leaders? If so, how does meritocracy develop this kind of independent integrity, the strength of the individual against the collective? Or do meritocrats simply support the direction that's chosen at the top? Is good government about strategizing and carrying out objectively determined policy? If it's only that, meritocrats might do it well, but who is to determine the policy? How does meritocratic development lead to the best policy for the future in a changing world?
Well, those are many huge questions. Let me just preface a little bit about my use of the term political meritocracy, because in the U.S., when we think of meritocracy, it's often used in a kind of economic sense that we should distribute resources according to ability and contribution rather than according to family background and class, whereas I'm using the term here just to mean to just to refer to the idea that a political system should aim to select and promote leaders with superior qualities. And those qualities, I argue, should be intellectual ability, social skills, and virtue. Virtue here, I just mean in a minimal sense that the leaders shouldn't be corrupt, that they should be at least partly motivated by their desire to serve the political community. So I don't think that's very controversial. I mean, I think that no matter whether you're Chinese or not, ideally we want leaders who have superior intellectual ability. You know, you don't want a leader who misunderstands basic issues and is confused when it comes to implementing policy, right? I mean, and I think we want leaders who have superior social skills, who can persuade others to get things done in an effective way. And we also want leaders who are committed to the community and not just committed to their own private or family interests and are going to misuse public resources for their own interests. And I argue that this idea of political meritocracy has a very long history in China. It's been the dominant political ideal among political thinkers from the age of Confucius onwards. And it's been, and in imperial China for 1,300 years until the early 20th century, more or less it was implemented by means of first the examination system, which was used to select leaders, and then leaders were promoted based on their performance at lower levels of government. And what's very interesting is that the past 30 years in China, there's been this reestablishment of this political meritocracy where the public officials are selected first by examinations and then based on performance evaluations at lower levels of government. And it takes literally decades to rise from the lower levels of government to the top. Now, it's a highly imperfect system and it needs to be improved. And there's lots of criticisms about how it actually works and how it ought to be improved in the book. But I argue that as a model for selecting and promoting leaders, it's a good model. It's potentially morally defensible and politically realistic, and it fits Chinese political culture. And as you suggest, it has a lot of support in the people at large. That's not to say that there's not a need for other things, like much more openness and a certain amount of democracy. And I'm Canadian, you know, so it's hard for me to think of morally legitimate alternatives to one person, one vote as a way of selecting leaders. But I do think that the longer time you spend in China, the more, you know, it becomes kind of obvious that it's a mainstream view that there's a different way here, different understanding of how leaders should be selected. And in the book, I argue that at the lower levels of government, it's fine to use electoral democracy. The issues are fairly not so complex at the lower levels. If you make a mistake, it's not the end of the world. And the people know the quality of the leaders. But the more you go up the chain of political command, the more meritocratic the system should become. Now, I'm not saying that this system should be adopted in the U.S., but certainly in China, where there's a long history and it's been reestablished in an imperfect way but over the last 30 years, but that it's a model that I think should serve as the basis for judging what counts as political reform in the future. We shouldn't just say China should move towards our vision of one person, one vote. And if there's not one person, one vote to select leaders, then there's no political reform. I think that's a mistaken way of understanding the Chinese political system. Now, I didn't really answer so many of your questions, but but why don't you push me on some of them?
We could use some of this in the U.S., but I'll come to that in a minute. David Brooks says in a recent book, The Road to Character, that meritocracy is not sufficient to enable the development of character. Your meritocratic skills include emotional intelligence and virtue, which you just mentioned. You say Chinese people expect their leaders to be virtuous. So can these traits be developed meritocratically? Can people be tested for such traits?
Well, they could be tested for some things. Like I mentioned, the three relevant qualities are intellectual ability, social skills, and virtue. And examinations can examinations are imperfect. We know that. But remember, there's a famous defense of democracy that it's a terrible system except for all the others by Winston Churchill. To test for intellectual ability, examinations is a terrible system, but all the other systems are even worse. So at least using examinations to like filter out those without superior intellectual ability, that is more or less effective. And I've looked at the examinations to test for public officials, and they're more like high-level IQ tests, extremely difficult. So to at least intellectual ability. Social skills, how do you test for that? Well, the most important way is looking at performance evaluations at lower levels of government. If the public officials can effectively persuade their peers and their superiors and their subordinates to get things done, then that's a good indication of their level of social skill. The most difficult part, though, is virtue. how do you test for whether people have a good level of moral character? And the big problem in China, I think, in terms of the quality of public officials, isn't just there isn't their ability and social skills. They're generally pretty high on those. But as we know, there's tons of corruption in China. And part of that is because the way of testing for virtue hasn't been an effective way. And what has been the main problem? The main problem is that who judges the moral character of public officials considered for promotion? Usually it's been their superiors. And the superiors are notoriously bad judges of the moral character of the candidates being considered for promotion. So in the book, I look at a lot of social science studies, and it turns out that the peers are those who work with you on an everyday basis at a similar level of rank are much better judges of moral character. And as a way of testing for virtue, it would be very important to give more emphasis on peer evaluation rather than judgments by the superiors. It sounds like a trivial thing, but in a system that aspires to be meritocracy, it's a hugely important thing.
One of my personal interests is inequality. It's a growing global problem. It's high in the U.S. and it's high in China, approximately at the same high levels, 0.45 or something like that on the Gini Index. How do you see meritocracy potentially enabling better solutions to this growing crisis in China or elsewhere? Economists agree that economic growth is necessary but not sufficient to remedy poverty and inequality. Is that part of the answer? Does meritocracy, as in China, result in faster growth? Your writings talk about compassionate meritocracy in places like Singapore. Can you elaborate on this as it relates to inequality?
Okay, so the big over the past 30 years, there's been basically consensus among reformers and most intellectuals about what the government should do, and that is poverty reduction. So government officials are promoted on the basis of whether they could in their own districts over which they govern, there's high levels of economic growth, because that was most important to reduce poverty. And China has done well at that. I mean, arguably, it's an economic miracle. Hundreds of millions of people have been lifted out of poverty. But now there's a realization that there's huge problems, including huge gap between rich and poor and environmental sustainability. So on this question of huge gap between rich and poor, I mean, partly it was a deliberate strategy by the government, right? Deng Xiaoping, you know, famously said, you know, let some people get rich first, because, you know, that's the way to get the economy going. It was a huge country and you can't do it all at once. So you have certain areas where people can get rich first. You know, they could be specially designated economic zones. And then after that, hopefully it would spread to the rest of the country. But now people realize, we have this huge gap between, especially between the people on the east and people living in cities and the rest of China. So the question is, how do we reduce that income gap? Now, China is a huge country. It's like a continent, right? There's not going to be a magic stroke. So you have certain areas. Like one of the, I think, advantages of the Chinese system is that you can carry out experimentation at local levels and see if it works there. And if it works there, then you could generalize to other parts of China. So you have parts of China like Chengdu, which is a huge municipality of over 10 million people. And their public officials are promoted now, first and foremost, on their ability to reduce income gap between rural and urban residents. If that works, then it could be generalized to the rest of China. And that could be done, to be frank, more in a kind of, in a system that has a kind of more of a meritocratic characteristics. Because imagine, you know, in Canada or the U.S., where there's a very, you know, strong federal system with each levels of government having their own powers, the central government can say to lower levels, you try this, and if it works, then we could generalize it to the rest of the country. But in China, you can. But the big issue now about economic inequality is really the need to attack the vested interests, because you have so many wealthy people now who use and often misuse political power to accumulate wealth for themselves and for family members. That's the big challenge, is not just to carry out experiments here and there, but literally to attack vested interests. And I think that that's part of what's going on in China. But it's a very sensitive time, because, as you can imagine, the vested interests don't go down, aren't going to, you know, go down quietly. So it's interesting times in China. I think it's harder to do in a country like the U.S. because, you know, it's anyway, for complicated reasons, but let's continue to talk about China.
Well, I'd like to give you that one, because it is clear that if we were able to choose a city like San Francisco, and if we had a meritocratic order or agreement for our officials that the measure of their performance was going to be on reducing inequality, Well, that would be very interesting, and I can't imagine, unfortunately, that it would happen here. But Chinda will be interesting to follow. I didn't know that. Thank you. So flaws with the American system is next on my question. We're at a point where our democratic government in the U.S. is seen by most of us to be flawed, maybe even failing. There is gridlock, inability to agree on major issues such as infrastructure, as I mentioned earlier. We can't agree on immigration. We can't agree on foreign policy. This doesn't seem to be the case in China. So maybe you'd like to elaborate a little bit on how meritocracy or the lack thereof contributes to these differences.
Well, so my approach, it's more, we can call it contextual political theory. I mean, I try to make coherent and rationally defensible the leading political ideals in a particular society. And in China, it's really about political meritocracy. But in the U.S., there's a long history of democracy, of people fighting for one person, one vote, and it helps to disadvantage people in many ways. And I would never say that the U.S. should adopt the Chinese political model. My point is that every system, especially for large countries, you're always going to have tons of problems. There's has advantages and disadvantages, and that we should allow for the possibility that China has a different system, which is not one person, one vote, has many problems and many advantages too, but that it's morally legitimate and politically realistic, and we should allow for the possibility that political reform should take place on the basis of its own model. But that said, is there anything that the U.S. could learn about the Chinese political model? Again, not saying that we should abolish one person, one vote. That's crazy, you know, and the U.S. has a rich constitution. People, all the debates should take place on the basis of that constitution. But you can have certain innovations that might be relevant. If for example, you know, if when people vote, there's lots of evidence now, social scientific evidence in the U.S. that many voters are, you know, not very sophisticated, you know, and that when they choose public officials, they don't choose them according to qualities that are actually helpful. So if there's better understanding of the Chinese model, then maybe voters would be more careful about voting for leaders who have these superior qualities like intellectual ability, social skills, and virtue. There might be other innovations as well that might be relevant for China. For the U.S. But again, I think it would be. I'm not saying that the whole political system in the U.S. should, you know, adopt the Chinese model. Definitely, that's not my view. In chapter one of this book, I basically try to argue that a political meritocracy can do certain things better than one person, one vote, especially in a big and complex country. But I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that there's two systems here that have advantages and disadvantages. Countries, the two major countries in the world, and that the Chinese would never say to the U.S., you know, you should completely adopt our system. But I just hope that the U.S. wouldn't constantly say, you guys are on the wrong side of history because you're not like us. I mean, that's if there's one takeaway from the book, that would be it.
One thing I suppose we could adopt if we had the mind is that Singapore, as I understand it, for many of its second level and lower government officials pay corporate salaries, millions, for example, and they choose the most capable of their corporate folks and rotate them in and rotate them out of those kinds of jobs. And we possibly could benefit from that type of application of meritocracy in our government, but we're not there.
Right. I mean, of course, in China, it's a relatively poor country. So as part of the way of dealing with corruption, there is this gradual increase of salaries of government officials at lower levels of government. So it would be helpful for China to adopt the Singapore model as well. But I agree with you that in the U.S., you know, if there's more respect for public officials and higher salaries for them, it would probably be helpful.
I want to ask you more about corruption, which is on everybody's mind in China. We have corruption in the U.S. for sure. You know, we're not free of it, but probably there's a lot more in China. You identify one of the major flaws in the Chinese system as historic existence of corruption has been there for centuries. On the Transparency International Index, China is 100 out of 175 countries measured, while the U.S. is ranked number 17. This is generally regarded, I think most people would say, as the most widely accepted measure of corruption in the world, but again, it's based on hearsay, it's based on interviews with people. Obviously, corruption cannot be actually measured. So take it for what it's worth. It's the way that most academics go to look at corruption. So Xi Jinping seems to have launched an aggressive anti-corruption campaign, but some people think it may be a tool to remove political opponents. I want to ask you what you think, but I wanted to at least to mention that in the papers the last few days, there's been this big explosion not far from where you live in Tianjin, and I noticed that people are attaching corruption to this. They're saying, oh, well, the people associated with the handling of these deadly chemicals are people associated with the government, and they probably got beneficial licenses too quickly, too easily. It's another example of corruption. And there's going to be a huge loss associated with this, which is estimated to be $1.5 billion. And some people say that loss is far underestimated. So in my mind, I said, okay, what does that mean? Maybe it's $10 billion. But then I thought, well, let's just think for a second what has happened in other countries relative to things like this. And I thought of Katrina. So I looked it up to see what has been the cost of Katrina. That was $150 billion. And wouldn't you say that was a failure of government in some way? Maybe not corruption, but maybe there is corruption, because a number of people who were governing the city of New Orleans and the government in Louisiana have gone to jail since then. And what about the tsunami? That was an estimated $235 billion. I don't know if there's any corruption associated with that. But these could be all regarded to be failures of government. And so putting that in perspective, can you tell us more about corruption in China and how it can best be addressed? And do you think Xi Jinping is sincere in what he's trying to do? And what about all that, Daniel?
So corruption is a huge issue, as you say. Just one little thing, though. That any big country, it's harder to manage well and to minimize corruption. It's easier to manage in a small country. And also, it's easier to manage corruption in a wealthy country where there's more money to go around. You can pay higher salaries and so on. And if you look at China compared to other countries at similar levels of economic development, it's not that bad. I mean, even according to Transparency International, India often is worse, as is Indonesia. But corruption is a worse problem in a country that aspires to be a meritocracy. Because in a democracy, if the leaders are corrupt or viewed as corrupt, the people can vote them out of power, right? If the leaders are still corrupt, you vote them out of power again. If they're still corrupt, well, then it's like the people's fault, not a problem with the democratic system. But in a system that aspires to be meritocracy, if the leaders are corrupt, it means that they're not meritocratic, they're not virtuous. So it's a problem with the political system, and it's a stake in the heart of the political system. That's why they view corruption in such a serious way. Again, you can argue that in India, you know, corruption is even worse, maybe not just in terms of how widespread it is, but in terms of how damaging it is to the overall economy. Because in China, even when leaders are corrupt, they were still judged on the basis of economic performance. So often the most corrupt ministries, like the railway ministry, still did a good job of, you know, building fast speed trains and so on. But it's viewed as a stake in the heart system. And so why is it now it's been the longest and most systematic campaign, anti-corruption campaign in Chinese history, not just Communist Party history, but all of Chinese history? And initially people thought, well, it's going to be a campaign like all the others. They just use corruption as an excuse to go after their political opponents. But to everybody's surprise, it's gone on much longer and in a much more systematic way. And of course, you know, Xi Jinping has to rely on his allies to carry out effectively. But it's more like corruption is the end, and then you relying on political allies as the means. And why? Again, because if they don't solve the corruption problem, literally the system will collapse. You know, they know in the civil war with the KMT, why did the KMT lose? Many reasons, but the key, arguably a very key reason, is that the KMT was viewed as more corrupt than the communists. You know, so it's been going on for 2 years. And I think it is having gradually some effect. I mean, when I go now to local government officials and to meetings, people think twice about misusing public funds in a way that didn't happen before. Of course, many other things have to be done. Independent supervisory institutions. You know, I think more freedom of speech is important, as separating economic power and political power. I mentioned earlier having more say to the peers in the promotion process. All these things, and as well as higher salaries, all these things are important. It'll take a long time. Initially, they're relying on very harsh means, but because corruption is a stake in the heart of a political system that aims to be a meritocracy, it's being carried out in such a dramatic and extended way. if I'm going to be optimistic, I would say that in 10 years' time, China will do better at dealing with corruption than in democratic countries at similar levels of economic development, because it's reviewed as a stake in the heart of the political system in a way that is not true in a democracy.
Thank you.
We'll see. Maybe I'm wrong, but we'll see.
Someone in the audience points out that there were 68,000 people put in jail, I presume associated with corruption in China last year. Do you think that kind of action is going to help to deter?
Okay, so in China, there's two main political traditions, right? One is Confucianism, which, to simplify a little bit or a lot, relies more on soft power to get things done. Rituals, moral education, moral example. But the other political tradition is called legalism, which isn't legalism in the sense of rule by law. It's more like relying on harsh punishments and fear to control people. And the first Chinese emperor, when he established China, was inspired much more by legalism. Mao himself arguably was inspired more by legalism than by Confucianism. So the anti-corruption campaign, to get things done quickly, relied more on legalist means. Harsh punishments and fear. That's the only way, they think, to get things done pretty quickly. But that's not a long-term solution. Ultimately, it has to be internalized and viewed as something bad, and there has to be institutions in place and incentives in place to reduce the level of corruption. But the statistic you suggested, you know, and also going after high-level people, is really meant to just change things very quickly, and that's more inspired by the kind of legalist tradition than by this other Confucian tradition. So, and that's not unusual if you look at Chinese history.
There's a question here about Confucianism and Buddhism, wondering what does this tradition, these traditions, bring to Chinese thought and government?
Well, Confucianism is the main political tradition. I mean, Buddhism arguably is more of a spiritual tradition and doesn't have that much political influence, at least now. It did in Chinese history and in parts of Chinese history. And the main contribution of Confucianism is that there's been all these debates over how to educate public officials so that they have higher ability and so that they serve the community. So part of the anti-corruption campaign is literally to educate public officials so that they internalize these views that they should serve the community and not misuse public funds for their own interests. So now many of the education programs for public officials are explicitly using much more Confucianism and less Marxism, because Marxism has almost nothing to say about how to educate public officials so that they're more motivated to serve the community. Confucianism has very rich resources. It's also being taught more in schools, because one of the problems in China now is that with economic modernization, people become more individualistic, and there's been a decline of social responsibility. Confucianism is a very rich tradition which promotes a kind of responsibilities within the family and with citizens and between countries and with humans and nature. So that's why Confucianism now is being promoted more and more in schools. And it's being done often in a quiet way, because the target isn't really liberalism, it's more Marxism. Because Marxism has very little to say about how to promote social responsibility among citizens, how we should promote the environment and more, how we should be more sustainable, and how we should educate public officials so that they're more care about the community. But it's very sensitive, because officially it's still a Chinese Communist Party, so you can't be too explicit. But this is happening slowly, more Confucianism and less Marxism.
There are a couple of questions related to the economy, if you don't mind. One starts out by questioning the zombie cities, the cities that are vacant that aren't being used. Another, the zombie companies, the ones that apparently are not really conducting much business. Maybe the broader way to ask this question would be about state-owned enterprises that some people regard to be inefficient and unproductive. What can you say about this? Is this a big drain on the Chinese economy, these kinds of things, when you see this?
Okay, well, I'm not an expert, but let me just say things. So about ghost cities or zombie cities, you have to remember, in China, there's been this huge transformation of people moving from rural to urban areas at a faster rate ever than in human history, and it's continuing over the next 20 or 30 years. An estimated 250 million people, almost like the whole American population, will move from rural areas to urban areas. How do they do that? Well, first they build cities, and then eventually they'll fill up. You know, so it's not necessarily as problematic as is often portrayed in the press. So you have to look at, you know, wait, let's wait 10 or 15 years and see whether these cities will fill up, and then we could judge whether they really are ghost or zombie cities. And even now, it's already happening, where many of the famously, you know, the cities that were labeled as these ghost or zombie cities are actually filling up with people. Of course, there's a lot of misuse of public resources and so on, but it's not necessarily as problematic as is often portrayed. As for state-run enterprises, that's the one disappointment so far in the economic reform since Xi Jinping took power, is that it's been very hard to go after them, and because it is very strong vested interests. But we'll see in the next few years whether there's more success in tackling that, because they really are drags on the economy based on what most independent analysts say.
Someone asked a question about the satisfaction of Chinese people with their government, so I want to go back to that and take a second more. I want to make sure that I made it clear that the Pew study showed that only 9% of Chinese surveyed in 2010 were dissatisfied. So that means 91% were satisfied. That's extraordinarily high, you know, way higher than most other countries and certainly way beyond us. Do you think, the question goes on, that this is a somehow or other skewed kind of statistic, or is it, in your opinion, truly representative of how you think, you live there, the Chinese people really think about their government?
Well, I think it depends. We need to separate between support for the constitutional system and support for the government and the actual leaders. So I actually think, in this sense, I actually think the U.S. is more stable, because even though many Americans might be against the government, but how many Americans I really want to overthrow the Constitution and have a completely different political system? Tiny number, I would guess. But in China, you know, that number would be higher. So in this sense, I do think that the U.S. would be more stable than China. That said, in terms of support for the actual leaders, it's one consistent finding is that the strong dissatisfaction at the lower levels, but the higher up you go, the more support there is for the policies and for the government, and also for this kind of more meritocratic system. There's strong support for what's called guardianship discourse. This view that what matters is not so much procedures for selecting leaders, but that we want leaders who have these superior qualities. Very strong support for that, and I don't think that's going to change much. Now, many political surveys, people say, oh, well, they're not really so representative. But they changed, you know, and also in a very authoritarian government without much freedom of speech, and people are maybe afraid of answering certain ways. So, again, analysts from outside have changed the political surveys. There's like little questions like don't know, that if you tick don't know, it's a way of showing dissatisfaction. Let all those, and still the results are fairly consistent. So I would say that there's more dissatisfaction about the overall political system in China than in the U.S., but there's still overall strong satisfaction for this kind of political meritocratic foundation. Whether the political leaders will have support, it really depends whether they can deliver on this giving jobs to people, opportunities, hope for the future. All those things are important. That said, a lot of people say that, well, look, if so much of the legitimacy of the government comes from their economic performance, what if there's a sharp economic downturn? Does that mean that the government leaders will be in trouble? Not necessarily. You know, that's what people thought in Singapore. Oh, Singapore, similar meritocracy, lots of constraints on democracy. They derive their legitimacy by economic performance. And there's a huge downturn in the economy in 2008. But the support for government actually went up. Why? Because people thought, well, it's not the government's fault that there's an economic problems, and that we still want to have good economic managers in charge in times of economic downturn. So long as the government is not viewed as the main culprit for the economic problems, and so long as there's a view that they could change things eventually, it might not be like a fatal threat to the whole system if there's an economic downturn.
Daniel, I think you answered at least part of this interesting question. It's what could cause democracy to become inevitable. What events would cause a disrupting change in China? And one of those that's a question here is economic distress. And I think the studies do show that the high ratings that Pew finds from Chinese citizens are somehow or other attributed largely to the economic growth, which has resulted in improved lives for so many people in China. And so if there was a significant downturn that was lasting and sustained, it's certainly, in the opinion of many people, possible that things could be very disruptive. There could be, you know, some fomenting of, let's say, a potential revolution. But I don't know. Personally, a guess would be that would take a big downturn, that would take a long, sustained downturn, far beyond what anybody who really understands these issues believes is likely to be the case presently. And that's why, I guess, maybe you want to comment on this, Daniel, the Chinese leadership has been so strong in controlling these kinds of events because they do not want to contemplate another Tiananmen Square or similar kind of uprising getting out of control in China.
Right, so there's going to be a lot of dissatisfaction in any big society. And I do think that eventually, as China modernizes, that it will have to open up much more than it currently is, with more freedom of speech, more freedom of association. But to preserve the meritocratic system, one person, one vote to choose top leaders would really undermine the whole system, because now the advantage of the current system is that the leaders could have this extensive training process, decades often. They could plan for the long term without worrying about the next election, and they could take sometimes strong measures that are necessary to preserve not just good economic performance, but other things that are important for government, including, you know, environmental sustainability. You have the long-term horizon to deal with climate change. You have to think about 50 years from now. You know, going to war. I mean, you mentioned China has done many things well. Well, they haven't gone to war since 1979, right? That's an important achievement. And for that, you have to have, I do think, so the question is, how can you have a more open society without, and it's important to preserve legitimacy of the system to have more open society. Because as you say, you can do two things, right? You can rely on harsh repression, have more another Tiananmen Square of fear, but that's not a long-term solution. A long-term solution for the system to be more legitimate is to have a much more open system short of electoral democracy at the top. And that's basically what I'm arguing for in the book. So my book has a very critical perspective on the status quo. I'm saying that in the long term, China needs to move towards a more open society, short of one person, one vote at the top. That's the only way to preserve the legitimacy of the whole system, and also to preserve the advantages of the meritocratic system. So many other things. You can have more freedom of speech, more freedom of association, more experiments with things like deliberation and participation. I even suggest that at some point there's going to be a need for a referendum on the China model, because only if the people have the strong support, clear, explicit support for the Chinese model of this kind of political meritocracy with a more open society, only then can the government relax and not be so paranoid about every little thing going wrong and resorting to harsh measures of repression, which really horrify me as well as anybody else, you know.
Someone sums up part of what we've just been talking about by saying, I've read that there's an unspoken understanding that the government will offer prosperity, economic growth, in exchange for the citizens accepting limited political influence, and so on. And I think both of us have said, yeah, there's truth to that at this point. But we have to acknowledge that it's probably true in most countries in the world that enough bad news economically for a sufficiently long period of time would result in political disruption. So here's an interesting question that I had a chance to ask Song Bing and Daniel when we were talking privately just earlier, but maybe they'd like to share this. Why have you not been arrested? And what pushback have you experienced from Chinese authorities writing these kinds of criticisms? I mean, you're complimentary of the meritocratic system, but you also point out the problems with corruption and other issues that are not sufficiently dealt with.
Right. So, well, look, I've been teaching 11 years and what you say in the classroom, you know, they really don't care. What is published in English doesn't really matter. But when it comes to translating in Chinese, then, to be frank, what I write is subject to severe censorship often. And this book has yet to be translated in Chinese. So that's the main problem that I face. And in private, you know, I'm with Chinese, with students, you know, with intellectuals, people are very open and very, very harsh. But if you were to, it's more like, it's a matter of publishing things in Chinese. Basically, the more influential the forum, you know, the more severe the censorship is in Chinese. And if I were to organize something, you know, then obviously I would get in trouble. But I, you know, I, that's not what I would want to do anyway, you know. So, so far, so good.
So you two are not afraid of someone knocking on your door late one night and that sort of thing, and removing you to some other location. You're not afraid of that kind of.
Not really. No, I mean, it's look.
China, I hesitated for a moment.
No, I mean, it's really look. That's why I think it's a mistake to lump up China with, like, you know, all authoritarian regimes. You know, North Korea. You know, Egypt. I mean, those are really, you know, like North Korea, like criminal state. You know, run by families that, like, kill people. You know, Egypt. I mean, think of Egypt. You know. China is not that bad so far, anyway. You know, we'll see. Yeah.
I want to talk just for a minute about Singapore. Of course, we both know it's a small city, nation, 5 million people or something like that. But you use it as a positive example. And there are elections there, but it's basically a one-party system. The Lees wield most of the political power. The deputy prime minister says recently, when he was interviewed by Fareed Zakaria, when he was asked what was his most significant accomplishment in his term, he said that the forced mixing of ethnicities was the most successful thing they have done. I wonder if you want to comment on this kind of thing. How has Singapore avoided some of the flaws of the Chinese system, and could some of that be applied to China?
So my first job was in Singapore. I lived there for 3 years, and there, since to go back to this question of the fear of repression, I was there in the early 90s, and it was worse than China now in the sense of being a professor. Like, I was told, you can't teach this, can't teach that, and the head of my department was an MP for the ruling party. But now it's much better. It's opened up so much, and I really hope that China can move in that direction too. I went back actually to write this book because China in Singapore, there's no restrictions on the internet, you know, so I had much better access. So I do think that Singapore has a lot of lessons to offer. That said, Singapore is a small site. It's much easier to manage in an effective way. And some of the successes that they did, like you said, mixing up ethnicities, it's very hard to do in a democratic context because the majority Chinese, like 77%, probably would have opposed it. Another thing they did in the early 60s was to make English the common language. Again, the majority Chinese would have opposed it. So they literally had to act in ways that would have been much harder to do in a democratic context. That said, in the long term, I'm not sure that the Singapore model is that sustainable, because they also have a meritocratic system. They were the first in the modern era to use this language of political meritocracy, and undergoing decades-long training for leaders and high academic achievers, subjecting them to all these tests before they could go into government. But I think the government is right that if the opposition is elected, it would literally wreck the advantages of the meritocratic system. And so Singapore attempted to build this political meritocracy on a foundation of electoral democracy. There is this inherent contradiction which you don't have in China. If China can do better at improving the meritocracy, like dealing better with corruption, improving meritocracy, making it a more open society short of electoral democracy at the top, it's a more sustainable model, I think, than Singapore.
I'm interested in this question. Why is there tension between China and the Uyghurs? Maybe some people don't know that the Uyghurs. You might want to explain, Daniel.
Right. So China, you know, it's a community in Xinjiang province, which is a Muslim community, to be frank, I think that's a problem with the kind of Marxist outlook of the leaders, where they do tend to think that so long as you throw money at people and improve their material conditions, that they will change their kind of religious outlook. I don't think that's going to happen, whether it's in Xinjiang province or in Tibet. So I do think that the government needs to be a bit more, you know, respectful of multiculturalism than it currently is. That said, I mean, if the Uyghur community, some members resort to terrorist attacks, which obviously is going to make any resolution much more difficult.
Do you think the Chinese model poses a threat to the U.S.? Why do some people in the U.S. think of it as a threat? Not in the sense that China wants to change the U.S., but China's government is so different from the American democracy, it seems to cause a sense of threatening to us.
It shouldn't be. It's only threatening if we think that all governments that do not use one person, one vote to choose their top leaders are fundamentally illegitimate, doomed to fail. Every little thing you read in the press about what's wrong in China means that the whole system is going to collapse. And China is viewed as fundamentally bad guy in the same camp as North Korea. That, if you have that outlook, then China is going to be viewed as a threat. But if you just say, okay, look, it's a highly imperfect society, lots of disadvantages, but the model is basically grounded in Chinese history, fits the political culture, has the support of many of the people, and can be improved on the basis of the current model, let's just allow for the possibility that there's a more legitimate and politically realistic alternative, that's fine. And most Chinese, you know, they like Americans, you know, very this-worldly outlook, you know, and, I mean, compared to some really bad guys, you know, who prefer, you know, like, you know, those people who would say, you know, the difference between you and me is that, you know, you guys like life and we like death, you know. Those really people, Chinese people don't belong to a different moral universe than the Americans. Just different political system, you know, okay, don't worry about it so much.
The NGOs, nonprofit organizations and so on, most recently China decided they were going to establish some regulations associated with how these organizations would be managed. And I guess the broader question, you can comment on this, but maybe the broader question would be, is there evidence in your mind that things are improving in some ways that aren't evident to us in the West in regard to human rights and freedom? Or do you see it as pretty stable or possibly moving in a negative direction?
Well, I think it's both in some ways it's positive, in some ways it's negative. So the positive parts is that over the past 10 years, discussions about the environment, environmental NGOs are much more, you know, active and public than they used to be. And even things like, you know, pollution, people are aware of it, talking about it, it's still restricted, but better. Even things like workers' rights, there's been perhaps some degree of progress over the past 10 years. But in other areas, you know, like we read about the clampdown on the lawyers who fight for human rights, and also academics face more restrictions over the past 2 years, it's gotten worse. Why? I think it's related to the anti-corruption campaign, because there's so many enemies now within the political, you know, organizing party that literally, you know, have their knives out for the leadership, that makes this, you know, the leadership more paranoid, you know, than usual. So the past 2 years, there's been this, you know, increased constraints on civil and political liberties. But if the anti-corruption campaign is successful, eventually less reliance on fear, more institutions, more emphasis on moral education, then I think the government can relax. Well, hopefully, will relax, and things will improve more than has happened the past 2 years.
And do you think Xi Jinping continues to have strong power in China, given all the pressures that you just described, including the fact that there are political interests which would like to see the anti-corruption campaign be terminated, for example? Do you think he's in pretty good control at this point? Do you have a view about that?
Well, I don't think it's. I mean, I know there's a lot of talk, well, China's like a new emperor. It's still, he has a lot of control, a lot of power, but it's still collective leadership, right? I mean, one of the advantages of the political system now compared to what went on before in Chinese history is that there's not one guy at the top who can just decide everything, right? It's seven people in the standing committee, and they still theoretically have to decide together. And arguably, it still works more or less that way, although Xi Jinping has more power than previous people in the collective leadership. So I think the threat, though, is that the big threat is that he would want to, or let's say threat. If, you know, one problem in a meritocracy is that you don't have this safety valve in a democracy to get rid of leaders, right? In a democracy, how can you get rid of leaders? Well, people vote them out of power. In a political meritocracy, you have to rely on different ways of accountability. So the main ways in which the leaders have been held accountable now are by term limits and age limits. They can serve 2 5-year terms and have to retire around the ages of 70. if that system is changed, like if Xi Jinping were to decide not to retire after two terms, then I think that would be a big threat, because it would mean that the advantages of meritocracy might, the disadvantages of meritocracy might begin to overrule the advantages.
Mm. I know you don't pretend expertise particularly about the military, but I don't think we can close this discussion on China without talking a little bit about the fact that Americans, to some extent, are afraid that China is increasing its military strength dramatically, seem to forget that today, with our military strength, we have more weapons, more spending on military than the next seven nations combined. But China does have, I think, 14 neighbors, and has struggling relations with some of those, and has lately been fighting over these islands out there. So what do you think about the military threat associated with China and what's going on there?
Well, I think for the long term, like 50 years from now, I can't imagine that the current system would still be in place, where China is like surrounded by these American military bases and that the U.S. has control over the sea lanes. I mean, certainly in the Chinese sphere, one, you know, can expect that China would have more influence. But I don't think... And so the U.S. might have to get used to that, you know, that eventually they'll have less influence around in the geographical area surrounding China. And that's, you know, bound to happen, right? The U.S. can't remain this kind of, you know, superpower with, you know, forever. But, you know, is China going to influence the rest of the world? I don't see that. And maybe it's important to get China on board to do things that the U.S. military does well now, like when there are major earthquakes and natural disasters, to send, you know, that the U.S. is, you know, sends the military to help and also to fight in piracy. I mean, the Chinese military is already engaging with that, you know. So I think it would be very important to, you know, do for both sides to try to promote the good things that the military can do.
Oh, we've got so many great questions here. Let me just choose one of them here out of the pack. Can you comment on the Chinese government's reaction to the umbrella revolution in Hong Kong? Are there still any reverberations in Beijing to these protests? How were they seen?
Well, so I think it was seen as a local protest. And so the umbrella revolution, it's mainly, you know, students who and others who wanted to have one person, one vote to select leaders in Hong Kong without the whole process being subject to basically vetting by the Chinese leadership in Beijing. And the good news is that the government didn't rely on extreme repression to deal with it, just in that they didn't rely on like Tiananmen Square style, you know, killings. The bad news is that it wasn't resolved in a way that is sustainable for the long term. I mean, my own view is that, you know, again, China, the advantages of this political system now is that they could carry out experimentation, including political experimentation. It's being done to a certain extent, but at some point, maybe one person, one vote at higher levels of government, including cities, might that doesn't challenge the whole Chinese model, you know, and if that's the future for Hong Kong, I don't view it as fundamentally challenging to the whole Chinese model.
I believe in your book you recommended that maybe China should have a referendum sort of thing, and the referendum would be to endorse the existing government structure, but asking for certain additional improvements in human rights, that sort of thing.
Right.
Is there any chance for something like that to happen?
Well, not now, because as mentioned, it's, you know, this very paranoid time mainly because of this anti-corruption campaign. And also, as you suggest, there's lots of support for the government. But at some point, as China continues to modernize, there will be much more demand for political participation. So one way of dealing with that is to have a much more open society. But to maintain the meritocratic system, you still have to have constraints on one person, one vote at the top. So how can the system be seen as legitimate? Well, it seems kind of, you know, obvious in a way that put it to the people. And if the large majority of people say, do you endorse this kind of meritocratic system with a much more open society, short of one person, one vote at the top, and there's strong support, then, and it's like a 50-year, you know, put it as like a 50-year question, long enough to maintain a meritocratic system, but without binding the people to perpetual meritocratic rule, then that would be one way to make the system more legitimate and more stable. maybe in 15 or 20 years' time. I expect that rather than an election, you know.
Maybe this will be the last area of question. We haven't talked about it, but it's really important and it's interesting. It's about the party, the so-called CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, and trying to better understand what role this party plays and why is it called that party. Daniel talks about that in his book. Personally, I don't even know what the word communist means anymore, but I don't know how it applies to China anymore, but apparently it's still troublesome to many Americans when that word is part of it. But maybe you could talk about that and about how the party factors into this and what you'd recommend in regard to that piece of it all.
So as a description of the political system of the ruling organization, it's highly misleading because, for one thing, it's not a party. It's a huge system that selects and, or you can put it a bit more negatively, co-opts the elites of diverse sectors of society. So just to give you a simple example, you know, in my department of philosophy, you know, you have some of the students and my colleagues would be party members. Some of them are socialists, some are liberals, some are Confucians, some are Buddhists. It doesn't matter. So long as they're high achieving and pass these tests of moral character and so on, then they're admitted to this organization. So it's 88 million people. 88 million, you know, the biggest organization in the world that literally aims to select and co-opt the elites from different sectors of society. So it's not a party, and it's meant to serve the whole people, not serve a particular sector of the people. So it's misleading to call it a party. And as you say, it's not communist. Since the Jiang Zemin regime, capitalists can join this party. So how can a communist party allow capitalists to become members, right? This is not an original point. In those days, too, they were talking about changing the name of the party. So to better reflect the organization, it makes sense to just change the name. And also, it has some democratic characteristics, too. You know, so why not call it something like, you know, the Democratic Union of Meritocrats or something like that that better reflects the reality as well as what it aspires to be. And as you say, it would be tremendous for the soft power for the rest of the world because you couldn't use this kind of communist boogeyman to, like, demonize the system anymore. But why don't they do it? Well, because, for one thing, the party or the organization still derives legitimacy by its communist history, right? And many elderly cadres would be horrified by the idea of changing the name of the party, but that's going to change in 20 or 30 years' time, right? It might not happen now. And in a way, it's almost like a Confucian reason not to change it, because you want, you know, these people, they're willing to sacrifice their lives to fight in wars to, you know, for the sake of the what they viewed as a communist, and almost out of respect for them, you don't want to change the name now. But 20 or 30 years time, you know, I'd be surprised. Look, in Mexico, the PRI, you know, the ruling organization, they changed their name, right, to better reflect the fact they were no longer, you know, no longer this kind of pure revolutionary party. They became this PRI, meaning the I stands for institutionalization, right? The Italian communists changed their name. I think it's bound to happen in China.
And in regard to that, up to now, most of the leaders across this period have been princelings, so-called, and that was true for Hu Jintao and Xi Jinping and so on before them. So do you think that is going to continue, or do you think that there'd be a possibility that meritocratic selection could actually allow for someone other than a princeling from the Maoist era, you know, a descendant of the Maoist generals, to be able to lead the country?
Okay, so I don't want to talk about the U.S., you know, but, you know, and the two...
The Clintons and the Bushes, yeah.
It's not necessarily distinctive to China. But that said, the examination system to select public officials was only implemented in the early 90s. And the current officials who are in power often from princeling families. Not all, right? Many are not. Like Hu Jintao wasn't from a princeling family. And now also in the standing committee, they're not all princelings. But those who got in it was before this kind of examination system was implemented. And they were selected in the early 1980s, partly because of their, not just because they were of their family connections, but because they had reformist credentials and because they had ability, you know. So But given that the system was implemented in the early 1990s, I would expect that you would have fewer leaders who are there at least partly because of their family backgrounds in the future. And the other thing, though, is that, you know, in terms of developing social skills to be a good political leader, I mean, to be frank, it helps if you're from a political family, right? I mean, I'm from a family in Montreal, and if I were to meet like even my MP, you know, when I was a kid, I thought, wow, you know. But if you're from a political family, you're dealing with all these political leaders at a young age, you develop these social skills and political skills, and so you'd expect a higher likelihood of people from political backgrounds to go into politics anyway. But I would expect fewer, given that this meritocratic system has been reestablished fairly recently. I would expect fewer in the future.
So, one question. How many of you feel at least somewhat more sympathetic to the Chinese system of governance after hearing what Dr. Bell had to say? Show of hands. Well, I'd say that's half the audience, Daniel. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.